welcome to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer, a show about negotiating relationships. I am your host, Batabi Lubuntobini, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. We have a very special show planned for you today. We are talking about project-based surrender. Considering the historically fraught nature of the relationship between communities of color and the criminal justice system, should churches, which have historically served as places of refuge, collaborate with the courts to resolve legal issues? I have two very special guests today. First, attorney Andrew G. March will give us some background about the legal process and about how a person who started out with a summons can find himself or herself facing an arrest warrant. Then, I am very thankful to be welcoming Reverend Joseph Jones to the show. He is a licensed clergy member and a liaison with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. He will tell us all about how Project Safe Surrender got started, and will also talk about the relationship between communities of color, the criminal justice system, and the church. You'll definitely want to call in to join in the conversation. I want to hear your opinion. My featured artist is Somi. You heard from her last week, and I'm closing out Women's Month by playing more music from her latest album. Later in the show, I will let you know how you can be part of the studio audience as she records her first live album. There's lots to talk about up ahead, so relax and enjoy. I'll be back with you in just a moment. Well, hello and happy spring. I'm so glad to be with you today. This is Batabi Lubuntobini coming to you live, of course, from Harlem, USA. And I've experienced one of a producer's worst nightmares in the last 24 hours or so. There really was a moment yesterday evening that I wasn't sure that the show was going to happen today. The guest I had scheduled for today's show got sick and had to cancel. He emailed me yesterday afternoon to let me know, and I'm glad that he let me know. of course, but the past 20 hours have been, well, eventful is one way to put it. You really don't know who your friends are until you have a crisis. And so I'd like to thank Ian Lynn out in Brooklyn for all of the hard work that he put into putting the show together on such short notice. So I've had a number of people working behind the scenes. Chief of them is Ian, who rallied the troops between Mount Pisgah and Another Chance Ministries and Antioch Baptist Church in St. Paul. Folks out in Brooklyn really got together and were very helpful in making sure that this show happened today. So I'm very thankful for that. I also need to thank Cynthia Williamston, Craig G, the hater, and my very wise sister who helped me keep it together as I did in one day what I usually do in one week. So this show is powerful. I'm really glad that it's happening, and I'm really grateful to see how it has come together on such short notice. I will try to reschedule the show about dealing with aggressive debt collectors. It is a very, very important topic. I know that a lot of you were eagerly anticipating having your questions answered and hearing from Jesse Langle, who is an attorney who specializes in consumer protection, especially where credit abuse is involved. And so I will make sure to try to get him back on the show when he's feeling better so that you can have your questions addressed on that topic. But for today, we're talking about another vitally important subject, Project Safe Surrender. That is a chance for people with outstanding arrest warrants, with low-level felonies and misdemeanors, to get those issues cleared up. I heard about the program from Ian, who is a member of Another Chance Baptist Ministries in Brooklyn, and I was really curious about this collaboration between the church, the community, and the criminal justice system. You know, it's no secret that relations between communities of color in particular and the police are challenged. And if I can use a mediator's understatement, New York City in particular has seen more than its share of trouble between communities of color and the criminal justice system. It is also true that for African Americans in particular, the church has been a source of refuge since the days of enslavement. So what happens when the church and the courts collaborate to deal with criminal matters in the community? Is this a good thing? I am so very thankful to have Andrew G. March with us on the show today. He is a former criminal defense attorney. He now practices family law, but he has experience with criminal defense and with the information about criminal procedure, and that's why he's here on the show today. And Pastor Joseph Jones, or Reverend Joseph Jones, who is the co-pastor of the Greater Zion Shiloh Baptist Church, who is a liaison with the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office and is, as far as he knows, the only licensed clergy member in the United States to hold that kind of position. He has been instrumental in getting Project Safe Surrender off the ground, and I'll be talking with him about that. I'll be asking Mr. March to talk about the procedural process, about how it is that folks might come to find themselves interested in taking advantage of an opportunity like the one that Project Safe Surrender offers. And then Pastor Jones will give us background about Project Safe Surrender and how it started and how it went last year, because this is now the second year that Project Safe Surrender has been underway. My understanding is that it was in the planning stages for a couple of years before it actually got off the ground. And so now this is the second time around for Project Safe Surrender in Brooklyn. And we'll talk about what he expects to happen this year. I'm also asking him to talk about this relationship between the community, the police, and the church, which is something he is eminently qualified to do since he has been working with the DA's office for 30 years. So I welcome you both to the show, and I'm going to start with Andrew talking about criminal procedure and how it is that a person might, first of all, get a C summons, what's called a C summons, and it will be helpful to hear about what a C summons is and how they might now all of a sudden find themselves having a warrant out for their arrest. which is definitely a really scary thing for the average person to think about. So I'm going to come to you in just a moment. I'm going to get your mic up. And I'm hoping that I've got the right number here. Okay, so Andrew?
Hear me?
Is that you?
Yes.
Wonderful. Thank you so much and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday afternoon to bring such important information to folks. Tell us a little bit about these violations. I went to the Project Safe Surrender website to see what kinds of crimes are covered in Project Safe Surrender. They're talking about things like consumption of alcohol in public, aggressive solicitation, littering, failure to have a dog license, trespassing, that kind of thing. So talk to us a little bit about what is a cease summons and what are people supposed to do when they get one?
Okay, it's pretty much what you alluded to in your opening remark. They're pretty much low-level criminal, low-level offenses, if you will. Obviously, the jail system is pretty much crowded or overcrowded, if you will, and not everybody has to get arrested. So therefore, in lieu of an arrest and having the person go through central booking for what would be considered a low-level misdemeanor and possible some type of felony, they could either issue a summons or a TAT, a desk appearance ticket, give the person the option of paying the ticket, or if they contest the ticket, to come to court and, you know, basically give their version as to what happened, whether or not they deny the allegation. For example, if it's consuming alcohol in public, you know, they'd have the burden of showing no, it wasn't alcohol or something of that nature. Or they could basically work out some kind of an agreement with the ADA, pay the ticket, and basically keep it moving, for lack of a better phrase. What happens is most people, or a lot of people, either ignore the summons and do nothing. They don't come to court. They don't pay the summons, and they just basically say whatever. And when they do that, then obviously that's when a bench warrant is issued. Because what happens is when the ticket is scheduled for a certain date that the person has to appear in court, if the case is called and the person is not there, then obviously it's a bench warrant that's issued. And that's what happens when you don't go to court. So once the warrant is issued, then you have to take care of the warrant. Now the issue becomes, how do you take care of that warrant? Obviously, if it's one of those warrants in which you could easily pay the summons or a low-level misdemeanor, things of that nature, you could go to the court, go to the clerk's office, tell them that you missed your court date for whatever reason and that you want to see the judge. And that's what will happen. And, you know, it's not a overwhelming procedure. It's just one of those things in which people make it worse than what it is. You know,
I wanted to ask you actually about that, you know, taking it sort of step by step. A person is issued a summons, and generally speaking, they know that they've been issued the summons because the police officer saw them doing something and issued them the ticket right there in the street or wherever it was.
Exactly. And the ticket says, okay, you have to appear on court on this day, or give you the option of paying the ticket, whatever the case may be.
Right. So they've got the option to appear in court. You've worked in this area as a, you know, you're formerly a criminal defense attorney. Have you had clients who were in a situation like this and gotten to talk with them about why they skipped the court date?
Sure. A lot of times is that they forgot about it, number one, or number two, they just basically figured that it would go away, that it wasn't a big deal. But it's something that has to be taken care of because, you know, it's in the system. And once in the system, it's going to remain in the system until something happens.
So then what happens with this desk warrant? Now, it's an actual warrant for arrest?
It's a bench warrant. So, for example, if they issue a warrant for you and you get pulled over, and you don't know it, or if you get stopped by the police and they won't run a warrant check, they could arrest you on the spot. You know, it might show up as to what the warrant is for, and, you know, depending on the police officer, he could tell you, hey, go to court on this day to take care of this, or you're going to find yourself being held and appearing in court to resolve the issue of the warrant. And what's going to happen is, depending on what the ticket is, if you get arrested, it's going to take you some time to get booked and processed. And by the time you get to court, more likely than not, the judge will probably give you credit for time served in lieu of paying the ticket, or they might just say pay this amount and give you a date in which it has to be paid by. But now, because you forgot to take care of it in the first place, you find yourself going through the process of having to be arrested, booked, fingerprinted, being held, and then seeing a judge.
So how long might it take for a person to be processed? How long are they going to spend in jail?
It varies depending on how many people are arrested that night. For example, typically everybody has to go through central booking, and that's everybody in New York City that's arrested. And you're talking about all five boroughs. Usually you would see a judge within 24 to 48 hours.
So you could spend up to 2 days in jail. Let's say you're driving down the street, you're going to the grocery store, and you miss the light, something like that. The cops pull you over, and all of a sudden you can find yourself going from your trip to the grocery store to 2 days in jail.
Exactly, just because you have an outstanding warrant that has to be addressed.
That's deep.
Yeah. So, obviously, it depends on the booking process, because if you get arrested at the wrong time, then you're going to not be able to see the judge until the next day. But typically, they try to see you, they try to get you before the judge within that 24 hours to 48 hour time.
Okay.
But there is a guarantee.
Now, let me ask about these violations that lead to a summons being issued. Are they the kind of violations that have jail time attached to them as a matter of course?
Well, when you say a violation in and of itself does not carry jail time. It could be like, for example, a disorderly conduct charge that doesn't carry jail time, but a misdemeanor charge, if you say DUI or something like that, could carry up to a year. You understand? So it's not like if you get a violation, which is synonymous to getting a ticket or a summons, it usually comes with either paying a fine, or if you cannot pay the fine, then you would have to do some kind of community service in lieu of the fine.
Right. Okay. So what I'm getting at is that you could go from being issued a ticket
that
over
doesn't
something
carry a jail
that
effect.
Has jail time, right, but end up spending time in jail.
Because
if
you failed to take care of the ticket when it was issued, exactly.
Wow, okay, so that's what I'm getting at. And that's what I want to hear listeners to hear. It's really important to get these things taken care of, because you can go from a situation where it was a fine, and nobody wants to pay a fine, but there you've got it. You have an opportunity to argue the issue. If you go to court, you have an opportunity to argue it. How is it in terms of getting these cases dismissed?
Well, it depends. A lot of times the officer won't show up. Depending on what it is, if the officer doesn't show up, then the ADA can't go forward. And, they typically would dismiss the case, depending on, the situation. But for the most part, a lot of those summons, tickets, or whatever are dealt with either by reducing the amount of the fine or working out the amount with the ADA or by doing some form of community service. For example,
okay,
if you don't want to pay, $150, they might have you do, up to 8 hours of community service in lieu of.
Okay. And let me ask, when you've been arrested then for a warrant, what happens to your record?
Well, it's a violation, so it's not a criminal record. You understand? It wouldn't be on your criminal record as a crime.
Okay. If you were to be applying for a job somewhere and they ask, have you ever been arrested, would you have to disclose this kind of an arrest?
I would say No, because it's on your record, it will show up as, if it shows up, as a violation, as like a summons. You understand? Mm-hmm. It wouldn't show up as you being arrested for a misdemeanor or a or felony. But then
okay.
again, it all depends on, you know, what you are applying for. Because even though somebody may have an arrest warrant, I mean, may have been arrested, it matters in certain areas. For example, like an FBI would have access to a person's record, even if it was expunged, even if the arrest was a result of some kind of, mistake, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I know attorneys, like when you apply for your bar application, it asks if you've ever been arrested before. Now, the
mm-hmm.
issue is not whether or not you were wrongfully arrested, whether or not it was a misdemeanor, felony, et cetera, et cetera. The question is, where are you arrested? You understand?
Right.
But if you don't disclose that, then that goes towards your moral character to practice law.
Right.
You understand that? So by not disclosing it, then it would become an issue. But it all depends
right.
on the employer.
So in certain contexts, it could have an implication as well.
Exactly.
Just based on the fact that you didn't show up and negotiate and pay your fine. Then, of course, with misdemeanors and felonies, there may be jail time attached, but having the summons issued in the court date gives you an opportunity to deal with it without having to go through the arrest, right?
Exactly. And I found that, like, a lot of the low-end misdemeanor cases depend on the person and whether or not the person have a record or not. They'll offer an ACD, which is called an adjournment in contemplation of dismissal, for a period of time from up to 6 months to a year. Now, if the person doesn't get in any trouble between that time frame, then that case will be dismissed and expunged, sealed from the person's record.
Okay. So with misdemeanors, then that is a possibility as well, another way of working it out.
Yeah, with a lot of, see, right now they got a lot of programs, you know, for example, you know, dealing with misdemeanors in which a person could actually, when it's all said and done, come out of the situation with no criminal record.
Okay.
For example, some people have like DV, domestic violence charges.
Mm-hmm.
They might want them to complete a batterer's program, you know, 32-week program, 24-week program, whatever the program might be. And upon completion of the program, then, you know, they could get an ACD or a conditional discharge, and they wouldn't have a record.
Right. Well, I went through all of this because, you know, I want people to understand that there are incentives to getting this taken care of. I was kind of surprised when you said that some things that you hear as reasons for people not showing up in court is forgetting. I mean, I don't think I'd forget something like that.
You'd be
well, I mean, you know, if the threat of arrest is attached to missing the court date, I think that would be pretty important.
But I think a lot of people don't realize that they could get arrested for it.
I see. You know, well, now y'all
like,
know.
Some people might, okay, I missed my court date. There are those people that actually believe that, okay, I missed my court date, then, you know, that's it. Oh, well, I'll get something else in the mail, or I'll get some kind of notification from somebody to say, hey, you missed court, you need to come to court, and then to resolve the situation. That doesn't happen.
So there are no notifications?
If you missed court date, a lot of times they might not have your accurate information, you know.
Uh-huh.
They don't typically say that. Like on the ticket, it tells you that, you know, your failure to appear could result in a warrant being issued for your arrest and things of that nature. I don't think that the court goes out their way to be like, okay, this person missed court, we're going to send them a notice to say that, hey, you missed court, you need to come to court and take care of this, or else you might be arrested.
Okay. So then, yes, it could come as a surprise to somebody who is uninformed, which they shouldn't be after having listened to this show.
And I've actually dealt with a lot of police officers who would tell the person, like, hey, you know, come to court, deal with this issue, because if you don't come to court, they're going to issue a warrant for you.
Okay.
And
all right.
Then, when the officer issue a ticket, they'll tell you that situation.
Right.
And depending on what the thing is, like I said before, sometimes the police officer may not show up. And in that case, the ticket would be dismissed. The ADA would, you know, maybe offer a reduction in the amount of the ticket itself, you know, from a, whatever the case may be, save you the court cost, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, you have to be there in terms of trying to negotiate a reasonable settlement on your behalf.
Okay, okay. Well, thank you very much for that information and that background that I'm hoping will be helpful for listeners as they contemplate the program Safe Surrender and understand what its purpose is for. If you don't mind hanging out for a moment, I'm going to put you on hold.
Sure.
Thank you very much. And now I'm going to turn to Reverend Jones, who was and has been very instrumental in getting Project Safe Surrender off the ground. And I'd like to ask you about your role with Project Safe Surrender and about your work with the District Attorney's Office. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much for coming in at the last minute, really at the last minute, and joining us here on the show.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
So please tell me more about your work with the District Attorney's Office.
Well, 30 years ago, I was hired to be an assistant clerk to the arraignment program that we had at the DA's office. And over these past years, we've been elevated to the position of the borough-wide clergy liaison, which means that I go to every church, every denomination in the Brooklyn area, and inform them of the services at the district attorney's office in way of the over 36 alternative to incarceration programs that are available to persons that happen to be arrested for one reason or another or just need some services through other programs we have, and inform as many churches and communities and as often as possible to let the churches know, to disseminate it to their members, and also collaborate with this different pastors and churches to try to get them to open their doors for certain youth programs, senior programs, drug programs, to assist us in helping people not to go to jail. Mr. Charles Hines has a mantra that says the easiest thing he does is put people in jail. The hardest thing is to keep people out of jail. And we cannot warehouse our way into public safety. So just throwing everybody in jail never solves the issue of criminal activity in our communities. We have to find ways to undergird people with help and support and services whereby they might be able to get back on their feet, get off the drugs, get out of the lifestyle of gangs and thievery and other things that cause people to do the things they do that get them arrested. And then not only will they not reoffend, maybe some won't even have to be arrested because of the example that their family members or their friends have gone through the DA's office here in Brooklyn, and they won't have to go through the system.
Right. So you're talking about Charles J. Hines, who is the district attorney for Brooklyn, which is Kings County. And
yes, ma'am.
It's interesting for me to hear then that he has a real dedication to keeping people out of jail.
Yes, he's been doing this for over 20-something years, and his attitude is that if you take a drug addict and arrest them for some drug offense and just put them in jail, they're still a drug addict. They'll still have access to some drugs in prison, and when they come out, they'll be a drug addict and a trained criminal drug addict from the other criminals that were in prison. And within anywhere from 3 to 6 months, they'll reoffend. That means you're going to have another victim, another cop, putting his life on the line to try to arrest him. And you start the vicious cycle all over again, which destroys families, destroys relationships with children and wives and husbands, and doesn't fix anything. Because no matter how much time you give a person, if they survive, they're going to come out worse off than when they went in. So it just makes common sense to try to offer some kind of program, some kind of service, that instead of incarcerating them, maybe we can get them into a drug program, maybe we get them into an alcohol program, get them into a counseling program, get them into a youth program where they can be somewhat changed in their mindset and their behavior, that they won't offend any, commit any criminal act. And the carrot would be either a lower sentence or even a straight dismissal in some cases, where they won't even get a criminal record as long as they complete one of the programs.
So tell me about what kinds of crimes a person might commit, where they can go in, you know, they coming into court expecting to have the book thrown at them and then discover that they've got these programs available. I mean, I'm curious because you said that there are over 30 programs that you were talking about. You know, how is the decision made that this person would benefit from this program?
Well, most of the charges are normally misdemeanor crimes, and then there are some felony charges that, like robbery charges, assault where the victim is not hospitalized any real length of time. But a lot of the drug offenses, if the person is a drug addict, they definitely qualify for many of the programs we have. If a person is a drug dealer who's selling drugs for his own profit, we don't make that offer to a drug dealer. We don't make those offers to an arsonist or to a rapist or to a murderer, but we will make offers to a, so let's say, for example, a 17-year-old kid who got caught up in the gang life and in the middle of some gang fight where his involvement was minimal, even though he was there and somebody got beat up. If that person wasn't hospitalized any length of time or there was no final damage to that individual, they will be eligible for one of our programs, not necessarily immediately accepted, but at least they will be eligible to be assessed, to be put into one of our programs.
Okay. And when it comes to assessment, are you able to talk about what things the folks who are making the decisions about this are looking for?
Yes. Matter of fact, at least three of the programs I wrote for the DA's office, so I was part of the assessment process, setting up the assessment process. Especially
so you know it very well.
Yes, I wrote it.
Right.
Project Redirect is one of our alternatives to incarceration gang program in the DA's office, where young members who have been charged with some type of gang assault or gang robbery, I do the assessment, and we assess whether this person is eligible for our program. And if they are, we put them in the program, and at the end of completing our program, we offer them a straight dismissal where they won't have a felony charge. And we actually help them get into school, help them get opportunities for jobs. They're no longer drug addicts. They're no longer alcoholics. They're no longer abusive. We have counseling and things of that nature. And many of our programs have those components.
Talk to me about the success rate. What kinds of results are you seeing from the program?
Well, believe it or not, right now, any success with many of these programs would be considered an awesome success because, one, this district attorney, Charles Hines, is one of the only DAs doing these kind of programs in the country. There's several others who have piggybacked off of many of his ideas. But, like, for example, we have a program called Calm Alert where people that are returning home from prison are offered an opportunity to come into the Calm Alert program, and they get immediate services in dealing with life skills and dealing with reintegrating back into society. In some cases, we help them get employment. In many cases, we help them get Medicaid, help them get their driver's license, help them get their birth certificate, help them reintegrate into society by going to school, getting their high school diploma if they didn't get it while they were imprisoned, reconnect them with families, offer them counseling. And these are people that are returning to Brooklyn. Now, there are over 380 people returning to Brooklyn every month from upstate prison. So if we didn't offer these services, these people would just wander the streets or reoffend. And we right now, instead of having 8 out of 10 go back to prison with our program, we only have 2 out of 10 that go back to prison.
Wow. Well, so, there you've got a success rate.
Significant,
very significant.
Right.
I want to talk about how you've developed Project Safe Surrender in just a moment. I want to take a moment to take a bit of a break.
Okay.
So if you could hang out for just a moment, we're going to take just a bit of a break. I want to play for you a song by Somi that is called Wallflower Blues, and I want to remind you that Somi will be at New York City's legendary club, the Jazz Standard, this coming week on Tuesday, March 29th, and Wednesday, March 30th, 7:30 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. So that's a total of 4 sets over the 2 days or the 2 nights. And she will be recording a live album. So it's an opportunity for you to be involved in this very historic moment. And so if you'd like more information about that, you can go to her website, www.somimusic.com. That's S-O-M-I. music.com, and there you can find out how to reach the Jazz Standard for tickets. So please enjoy this music and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the show. This is Batabile Mtombeni coming to you live from Harlem, USA. And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. I am a mediator and relationship coach, and Untangled Resolutions is a private practice in mediation. We help folks to negotiate their relationships. I am happy to have with me on the show today Reverend Joseph Jones, who is the co-pastor of the Antioch, he's the co-pastor of the Greater Zion Shiloh Baptist Church out there in Brooklyn, and he's also a liaison in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office, working with them and with some of the programs that are alternatives to incarceration. And I've just heard from him that he has been instrumental in developing some of those programs that are working to keep folks out of jail, and for folks who are coming out of jail, making sure that they are able to reintegrate into their communities so that they have resources and are not finding themselves in a place of desperation where they commit further crimes. So I'm really honored to have him here because I understand that he's doing such wonderful things for the community. So I'm going to come back to you, Reverend Jones. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. I'm glad that you're here. I'd like to talk with you specifically now about Project Safe Surrender. How did it get started?
Reverend Dr. Johnny Ray Youngblood, at the time the pastor of the St. Paul Community Baptist Church, had a friend in Ohio who was working with a marshals program, federally funded, called Fugitive Safe Surrender, where the marshals had partnered with some churches in Ohio to tell fugitives from the federal government that they can come to the church and meet with the judge and courts in the church and be safely surrendering themselves. By the time we got the program, the marshals program had ran out of funding. But we were so committed to trying to do it in Brooklyn, we developed our own program and called it Project Safe Surrender. And the first 2 years was just seeing how the program worked in other places. It was done in Newark, New Jersey as Fugitive Safe Surrender. It was done in Camden, New Jersey as Fugitive Safe Surrender, where the criminal justice system in that area was a little different than it was in the Brooklyn area. So we had to kind of conform it to our area because right now there are 500,000 open warrants in the Brooklyn area.
Oh, my. So, and just in Brooklyn?
Just in Brooklyn. I'm sorry, in the five boroughs. In Brooklyn, there's 350,000.
Wow.
So we didn't want to lose the opportunity because we didn't have any funding from the marshals, so we just decided to just do it on our own. So this first it was a 2 years learning the program, and then we did a pilot program in July of last year at the St. Paul Community Baptist Church where the pastors, Reverend David K. Brawley and Reverend Youngblood, had relocated his ministry to the Mount Pisgah Baptist Church in Bedford-Stuyvesant and collaborated with several agencies to host a pilot program telling people that if they wanted to come to clear up their summons or summons warrant, they could come to St. Paul Community Baptist Church, and we would vacate the warrant and dismiss the charges. No fines would be taken, and no one would be arrested. And we had great success. We didn't have the numbers we would have liked, but in any pilot program, you're just testing the waters to see if it'll work. And it came off very well, so now we're getting ready to do it again in a larger way, getting the word out to more people to come on April 22nd, April 23rd, where they can come to the Antioch Baptist Church at 828 Green Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, and from 9 to 5 on both days, which is Holy Friday or Good Friday and Holy Saturday, and have their warrant vacated and their summons case dismissed without paying any fines, any penalties, any fees of any kind. No money will be taken.
Now, that is a wonderful thing to be able to offer to folks. You know, I was curious about this concept of safe surrender, and you mentioned that that was an important facet with the Marshals Program and their Fugitive Surrender Program, that people were going to be able to come in and safely surrender. I am, of course, also curious about how it is that, folks are going to be able to come in and have their summonses cleared up without paying fines. But first, could you talk with me specifically about this concept of faith surrender, and what is the import of that?
Well, when the marshals did it, you know, their job was to go out and compel people to come in, whether they wanted to come in or not. So that may mean some physical doors being broken into and some aggressive behavior having to be elicited, because people definitely don't want to come in on a federal warrant. What spearheaded their program, to my knowledge, was that several officers were injured and some were even killed trying to serve these kind of warrants. So this program that they started, Fugitive Safe Surrender, allowed people to safely surrender themselves where their matter could be heard, not necessarily exonerated. This wasn't an amnesty program, but instead of being dragged in handcuffs and being, you know, fighting with the police or having your door kicked in at 2 o'clock in the morning and scaring your family half to death, you came into a church, a place of sanctuary and refuge for many people. And they were able to get their cases heard. And in some cases, some returned to didn't have to come back to court. Their matters were heard and dismissed. In some cases, some people were arrested and sent to jail based on the charges that they came in on. But when it comes to Project Safe Surrender, because we're only dealing with summonses, which are minor offenses, no one needs to be arrested. No one has to pay a fine. And they can safely surrender themselves without having the inconvenience, as the attorney spoke earlier, of being detained for 24 to 48 hours, depending on when they were arrested, their car impounded, depending on when they were arrested, the embarrassment of going through the process of trying to find somebody to bring some money down to the court so you can get out. All of that will be alleviated when they show up on April 22nd, April 23rd. All you have to do is come. We show your ID, because we have a unified court system. We pull up your case, bring it before the judge, vacate your warrant, dismiss the charges, and send you home.
So it doesn't matter if you were arrested in Brooklyn or in Staten Island or Manhattan.
Well,
you can come to Brooklyn?
That's the beauty of Brooklyn and the five boroughs. We have a unified court system. So if your warrant is in Staten Island, you can still come to Brooklyn and get it heard. If your warrant is in Queens, Manhattan, because we're unified, we have a computer system that can pull up whatever summons any person has in the five boroughs.
So it doesn't matter where the person lives. It doesn't matter where the summons was. Well, I mean, it matters where the summons was. Of course, jurisdiction is an issue. So long as somebody can't come in from Connecticut and have their case heard or warrant something that happened in the New York City area, but it doesn't matter where in the city it happened, they can still come
no,
to Brooklyn. Right.
No, it doesn't matter where it's at.
Okay.
Just as long as in the five boroughs.
Right. And so how is it working out then that there won't be fines, very specifically?
Well, the court has decided that they're more concerned about people being alleviated of the burden of having a summons warrant than trying to elicit funds. At that juncture, we won't be in a position right now, being that this is only our second time doing it, to take funds and collect monies from people. We want to show a great amount of integrity and compassion through the collaboration of the church and the court working together to let the community know that we're more concerned about people being inconvenienced, incarcerated, insulted, disrespected, in this fashion of something as simple as spitting on the sidewalk, loitering, riding your bicycle on the sidewalk, open beer cans, sit in the park after dusk. We're more concerned about them being freed of the so-called warrant so that they can now come out of the shadows. They can actually join the human race and connect with communities and services whereby they can be productive members of society.
Right. Well, I see here that I've got a caller on the line, but I'm really, you know, encouraged by the idea that the district attorney's office, which is generally seen as an enforcer, and of course it is their role to enforce the law, but also has this community well-being perspective whereby the good of the community from an individual standpoint, as well as from a larger standpoint, but, you know, that there is this idea of compassion being a good thing and being good for the community.
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm been on you.
Okay. I have a call on the line, and I will come in. This is a caller from the 909 area code, and I'm going to turn on your mic. Caller, you're on the air. What is your question?
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question for the Reverend.
Go right ahead.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to say, wow, I think that the program that you're doing is really, really great. I mean, somebody should have been doing this years, decades ago. You know, it makes all
yes,
the sense in the world. Right. When you mentioned earlier that you have programs for people who are coming out of jail, and I was wondering, do you have any programs for juvenile offenders?
Yes, ma'am. The juvenile offenders, we have a program called YCP. It's called Youth Congregation in Partnership, where if the person is underage, between ages of 14 and 21, they can be assessed for our program, partnered with our social workers to reenter school if necessary, college if necessary, or employment depending on their status. But in the same vein, they're partnered with a church, not necessarily for proselytizing or browbeating them about the Bible, but to offer a positive reinforcement of moral values, integrity, and structure, and keep that individual somewhat on the straight and narrow while the DA's office deals with the secular part of their life, making sure they're not drinking or drugging or committing any other offenses. We have church people that are trained by a social worker to just, you know, offer this young person support, mentoring support, take them out somewhere to a positive program, just be that kind of big brother or big sister that they may not have had in their life to keep them from reoffending for 1 year, and after that year, the case will be assessed for total dismissal or even a reduction in their sentence.
Okay.
We
wow,
also
that
have
sounds
a teenage,
nice.
We also have a teenage, I wrote a program called STAR, Saving Teens at Risk, which is for teenage prostitutes. So young ladies between ages of 15 and 23 can, if they're arrested for solicitation, instead of being incarcerated for 3 to 9 months or sometimes a year, we put them in a six-week program where they have to come to our office and be discuss their situation and try to get them back into school, get them into college, get them employed other than being a teenage prostitute, offer them services for their drug treatment, alcohol treatment, their social abuse, depending on their lifestyle, even relocation to get away from the pimp they may be connected with, domestic violence, order protections are issued. We offer them a whole bunch of services to try to help them never to go back to their lifestyle.
Okay. And you had mentioned that these programs are outside of where you are, because I know, like you said, you wrote some of them. Are they nationwide or just there where you are? Because I'm in California.
Unfortunately, they're Brooklyn-based. But because of the outreach of Mr. Hines being the vice president of the National Board of Prosecutors, I encourage people to go to our website, www.brooklynda.org, read up on the programs, and then go to your local DA in your area, your local officials in the area, and say, hey, how come we don't have these programs in our area? How come we haven't started? Because many of these programs started with no funding. But since we've done them, we've been able to petition grants and services from corporate vendors to support the program financially. So in the meantime, we've now created jobs
okay.
for people. So it's something that can be duplicated.
Hello?
I'm on the phone.
Sorry. And my last question was, you know, you've mentioned quite a bit that it's the church working with the DA. And I'm just wondering, does this cross the line with the issue with church and state not supposed to be working together? Or?
Well, initially, when you investigate the concept of church and state, it was basically so that the government would not mandate a state religion that everyone had to follow. We don't bother crossing the lines with how a church does their worship or how they do their services or whatever their belief system is. When we ask a church to partner in helping redirect a child's mindset or redirect a drug addict's lifestyle or behavior or offer support service to a domestic violence victim. They just speak about their life experiences. They talk about their moral values and the integrity that kept them out of trouble, regardless of their faith or their belief system. And then if they tack on, well, listen, the God that I bring into my life or the Bible that I read or the Quran or the rules that I follow is what kept me out of trouble. Doesn't mean you have to believe what they believe. It just means that this is what they're telling you that kept them out of trouble. So we don't They don't interfere with our legalities, and we don't interfere with their belief system, but we recognize that the average church, the universal concept of church, has always been something that's marked as a positive thing, not a negative thing. So that's how we kind of work with that church and state issue.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much. And I think I'm definitely going to go to your website because I think that that's a program that should be nationwide. That's just really awesome. That's
it
nice.
It does work. It does work.
Thank you.
And callers, thank you so much for calling in. Your questions were really important and were helpful in bringing out some important insights. So thank you for calling. I do want to mention to you, Reverend Jones, that I have flipped over to our chat room. There's a chat room that is attached to the show, so folks who are listening to the show can also be on their computers and talk back and forth with each other. So there are a number of conversations that go on at the same time. And I just happened to come over here, and it turns out that we have a listener named Bill Murray who has put up some information about the L.A. County Sheriff's Clergy Council. So it sounds as though we've got some programs going on in L.A. that you might find to be interesting, where clergy members are also involved. I'm not sure exactly the extent of their involvement and how it might mirror your involvement, but is that a program that you're aware of?
Yes, ma'am. Matter of fact, a coalition of clergy came from Los Angeles to help develop some of the clergy programs that we have here in Brooklyn to help us to also integrate better with our different elected officials. So we know there's several clergy councils all over the country. Right now we have I go to at least 15 clergy council meetings a month with different sects of clergy. We have the United Precinct Clergy Councils of Brooklyn, which are clergies that work directly with the police department in offering services to the community, disseminating information to the community, positive information to the community, while also making sure the police department understands that the clergy are a vehicle to help work with them, not work for them, in order to deal with community issues. We have the African-American Clergy and Elected Officials that meets once a month, and they have about 100 pastors that meet and deal with the elected officials from the local councilmen, senators, congressmen, to discuss the issues of the state issues going on with New York State. We have Brooklyn Congregations Together, which is the organization that is supporting Safe Surrender, where they're dealing with social justice issues. There is a bunch of clergy organizations that work together. We have CUSH, we have the 79th Clergy Council, we have the clergy councils that are in Queens that are partnering with churches here in Brooklyn to offer services. So there's a bunch of clergy organizations that are working in this venue.
So it's a really robust program and keeps you really busy.
Yes, ma'am, every day, all day.
Listen, I've got another caller who is in the 323 area code who has a hand raised here. On my switchboard, I get an icon with a hand up. It's really kind of cute. It's like being in school. That lets me know that somebody wants to come in on the show. So this is to the caller in the 323 area code. I'm opening your mic. See here if we can get it. There we go. 323, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, Reverend. It's delightful to meet you. We've not met in person, but I am the person in the chat room that she was referring to who's part of the L.A. County Sheriff's Clergy Council. I'm also on the LAPD's Community Police Advisory Board. And, you know, as you said, Reverend, we've been engaged in this for probably going back perhaps over 10 years anyway. In fact, for 10 years I've run what's become the world's largest grassroots organization that is devoted to community-based policing. And I have a secular ministry. I'm not attached to any particular religion. I do have a spiritual life. And they invited me into their clergy council years ago anyway.
Right.
So they're quite
wonderful.
They're quite liberal in their but it was basically myself and about 50 mostly black ministers at that time. Now the head of Scientology is there and some other, you know, other people are there, and maybe one or two other laymen. But, you know, I am so excited about hearing that you're doing well with this program. This is exactly the kind of thing, you know, that's needed to build the relationships between, you know, not just the law enforcement and the clergy, but the law enforcement, the clergy, the justice system, and the community. And that's the most important element, the community. Because that's what lowers the crime rate, and that's what makes the quality of life, you know, go up. And I'm a Brooklyn, a New Yorker, too. I lived in Brooklyn Heights for years, where I was born in Manhattan. I'm delighted to learn of this program, which I wasn't sure was up and running, but this is wonderful, wonderful news, and thank you so much.
Well, Bill, I'm glad that you called in, and I'll give Reverend Jones a chance to respond as well. Please go ahead.
I have a 4,000-page website. If people want to know what we're talking about when we talk about community policing, they can go there at lacp.org. It's updated every day, and it's been there for 10 years, and that's why the Justice Department's long ago called us the biggest worldwide grassroots organization devoted to this issue of community-based policing. And we bring in all kinds of things, and we're now a national effort. We were originally regional to Los Angeles only. So, you know, I say I don't want to dominate the show, but I did want to call in and tell you you're on exactly the right course from my perspective. And, you know, the most important element that I heard discussed so far is holding the community accountable, too.
Exactly.
When you mentioned that the young people that come into the program are required to stay, you know, trouble-free for a year and also to attend some kind of training programs and so forth on a regular basis, and that if they complete that, you know, then there's an outcome. That's what we need. We need to understand that, you know, the community is accountable for itself, but police and law and justice and the ministries are all willing to lend their hand too, and we want nothing better than for the community to succeed.
Well, years ago, Brooklyn was full of community courts, which is what we're trying to push to go back to. There is a court called the Red Hook Court in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn, which you may know about, where a principal was a very beloved principal, was out looking for some kids in the project area of Red Hook that had been truant. And in the midst of his search, he was gunned down in the middle of the projects and died. And because of that, the district attorney worked in conjunction with several agencies and corporate people and actually got a donation of a building in the Red Hook area and built the Red Hook Community Court, which is on our website, where any case in the Red Hook area is heard in that courthouse with the same judge, and in that same courthouse there are services, resources, drugs, alcohol, GED, youth services, senior services, right there in their backyard. Court officers in the summer play ball with the kids, help them with their homework during school time. Lawyers are the same. The judges are the same. The personnel there is the same. So the court is part of the community, not an entity outside of the community. And right now we're in labor to try to give birth to the Brownsville Community Court, which is where we have the 7-3 precinct and connecting with the 7-5 precinct area, where we're trying to put a court there to actually have the same thing that happened in Red Hook happen in Brownsville. Because now, since that court has been there, businesses have now opened up. IKEA has come in and offered jobs and assistance to the area. The drug addicts and the gang violence that was there 10 years ago is not even almost non-existent because of that court being there. So we're trying to do the same thing in Brownsville, and we're going to try to do the same thing in Bed-Stuy. So community policing and community courts is exactly where we're headed. And, yeah, we are definitely holding the community council. The police cannot do this by themselves. Many of the police don't even live in our area, so they don't even know the dynamics of our community, so we can't expect them to work without having a connection with us. And then the churches, and you have to forgive me because I've been kind of a little hard on the churches, because you can't have church from a Saturday, a Sunday, and a Friday night, leave your house of worship and go home like what you did actually really matter to the community. You have to come out from behind the stained glass windows, come out from your beautiful sanctuaries, and engage the community in services and resources to help them to get past these criminal activities, these issues of just just silly crimes. You know, most of the people that get arrested these days, they're not arrested for trying to break into a bank and steal $1 million. They're not arrested because they actually were fighting off 20 people for their life. They were arrested for getting into an argument with their girlfriend and slapped her for some reason. They had no business hitting her and that kind of nonsense. Or some 19-year-old kid is sticking somebody up because he's been smoking marijuana for the past 6 months, and mom and dad didn't know what to do and where to send him, and now he's been arrested for breaking into some store, somebody's car, stealing a radio, looking at 3 and 4 years for that kind of nonsense. That can be fixed if the churches would disseminate information and resources and services to say, hey, you don't have to do that. We got some services. We got some help for you. Just come to us. Forget about our denomination. Forget about whether you're this or you're that. Just come over here, get the services, and go back and live a fulfilling life. And the DA in Brooklyn is all for that.
Well, we have a program that I thought was the best thing since sliced bread, and it's gone away temporarily, but I hope we'll get it back. I'm fighting for it back. It's called Local Prosecutors, and it's similar to what you're describing, where there are prosecutors that are assigned to police districts. They're called areas or districts in Los Angeles. And they stay attached to that district, so they learn who everybody is. And as you're saying, it makes all the difference in the world that they're not new to a case, you know, new to a jurisdiction and so forth, that they live within that. Well, they don't live, but, I mean, they work, and their whole career is spent within that area, and they catch all those what we call lower crimes, mostly the misdemeanors and so forth.
Right.
Because if you can catch these things early, you can turn a kid around much easier than if it's a more violent or serious offense that goes to the level of a felony later. But somebody in the chat room asked if we can keep statistics, and I'm not sure if Brooklyn's been doing it long enough to be able to do. But I can tell you that we can do that in L.A. because it's been going on long enough that statistics have been compiled. And one of the basic biggest statistics that law enforcement all over the country would use is the homicide rate, because you can't hide a homicide. You know,
no, you can't.
They're obvious. Well, it's now about 300 a year in Los Angeles, but it was over 650 a year when I started LACP. So it's less than 50% of what it used to be. It's 100% less. 100% less than it used to be.
Well, I congratulate your success. We're headed in that direction as well. We have statistics on many of those things as well, homicide being one of them. And we were at 277 last year. And sad to say, many of those were African-American men. And many of the people arrested for it were African-American men. And many of them incarcerated were African-American men. So when I hear this stuff...
In L.A., of course, it's a combination of African-Americans and Latinos. In fact, the two groups do fight against each other, too, but it's also internal to their own communities, more or less. But, you know, this is the direction that I just want people to understand. You don't have to be a minister to get involved in this.
Please don't believe that. Please don't believe that. We're looking for lay people.
Right. If they're a person of conscience, and they have some time, and they're looking for a way to volunteer, this makes all the difference in the world. And I'm sure that you'll be put to good work, believe me, and it will make a huge difference in Brooklyn and the rest of the city of New York that you show up and keep showing up. So
that's right.
I don't want to dominate the show, as they say, but I really applaud all these efforts I'm hearing about, and I want to give kudos to you and all your people, and the show itself, for carrying this topic.
Thank you so much, sir. Congratulations to you as well. I'm going to definitely what is your website, anyway?
It's I started the website as my reaction to 9/11, and I was living in Los Angeles, as you know, at that time. So I called it LACP, LA Community Policing. But long ago, it's become a national, you know, effort, much like the L.A. Times is no longer a local paper. Everybody, you know, people read it all over the country. Mm-hmm. So LACP.org, LACP.org, you know.
Excellent. And, thank you so much.
You're welcome. God bless you.
Bless you too, sir.
So thank you so very much for calling in. And if you don't mind, I've got the website. I would love to get in touch with you and talk about perhaps talking about what's going on out in the L.A. area. This show is heard all over the place, and so I'm interested in talking with people from wherever the show is being heard. So, again, Bill, I really appreciate you coming in. Don't worry about dominating or anything. The information that you've provided has been very helpful, and I appreciate your contributions to the conversation. All right. Reverend Jones, you know, there's an underlying issue that I think would be, interesting to address. It is no secret, as I said before, that the relationship between communities of color in particular, I mean, there are numbers of communities that have had challenged relationships with the police, but in this area, we know about the relationship between communities of color and the police. And so it would seem from one perspective to be counterintuitive for churches, especially churches in black communities, to have this kind of collaboration with the criminal justice system. Could you talk with me a little bit more about that and what kinds of tensions there might be as you are doing this work?
Well, in any new project, there's always going to be some certain amount of question and certain amount of issues in dealing with us, the church dealing with the police department, our pastors snitches and telling on people and that kind of thing. And but what we've recognized is that when the police officer takes off his uniform, believe it or not, many of them go to church. They are part of the community in many ways. And anytime I go to community meetings where there's an uproar against the police behavior and the police actions, and this one is a little aggressive and that one was nasty, I tell them, well, listen, the police department is unfortunately a necessary factor in our communities. And anytime you don't believe that, I normally will pull out a piece of paper and tell everybody in the room, I want you to sign this paper as a petition to Mayor Bloomberg that in your area for the weekend, from Friday 5 o'clock until Monday 9 o'clock, we're going to ask Mr. Bloomberg to give every police officer in the area the night off. The weekend. let's get rid of them. Let's just still give them. I don't have to come that weekend. And put it in the daily news, put it in the papers, and let everybody know that there will be no police action in the Brownsville area for that particular weekend. Guess where I'm going to be?
Not in Brownsville.
Yeah, sure will be in Brownsville. Yes, we should hold the police department to the fire, but you have to hold them accountable based upon being involved on some level of having some relationship with them in order to help address some of their behavior, some of their issues, and offer support to them. One of the biggest problems we have in the DA's office when it comes to prosecuting cases is getting people to step forward and testify and tell us what happened because, again, of this so-called snitching issue or because of the danger from the community and the gangs and the thugs and the drug dealers, and if I say something, they're going to come after me and my family. And it's a real issue. It's a real situation. But how else are we supposed to prosecute people that really need to go to jail? How else are we supposed to get these criminals off the street if people won't come forward? Well, in working with the police department, we try to do investigations where we don't necessarily have to bring in a person. We can kind of talk here and there and get an idea of what happens and piece together enough of the information through the police and the collaborative relationship, through the churches, and try to get information where maybe the church has a camera that caught the whole thing on their camera, and we just let the camera do the talking for us rather than bringing in an individual, and try to get the pastors to get their people when they're coming out on different worship days to kind of look around and pay attention to the surroundings. If they see something that's egregious, or drug dealers working, or some type of house that's got an abandoned crack situation or drug situation going on, tell us about it so that the police department can do their own investigation and try to move that out the way. We can't expect the police to do this stuff by themselves, left to their own devices and their own. They're a paramilitary organization. Their answer to a lot of the issues dealing with the crime is to arrest people. They don't have a soft, soap, sympathetic, sincere idea. But if you have a pastor in a church and a layperson that's concerned, you can actually say, hey, listen, officer, let me talk to this kid. Let me endear this kid to my work. And maybe if I keep him busy, he won't get in your head. He won't get in your way before he commits a crime. And if he does commit the crime, let me stand up on their behalf and advocate for them and help them get back in school and work with them so that they don't come back from prison a worse individual. So there's a necessity of building bridges between the court, the community, the police, and the clergy to work together for a better community.
community and sources of stress. One of the things that I'm thinking has contributed to the large number of outstanding warrants and the need for a program like Project Safe Surrender has been the stop and frisk policy in New York City, which has made national and international news. What has been the impact of the stop and frisk policy in your neighborhood?
Well, it's been an ongoing issue of whether we should or whether we shouldn't. It has resulted in a lot of controversy because, of course, they feel like many of the officers are doing the stop and frisk, seemingly only stopping African-Americans and Latinos and people of color. But predominantly most of our communities and our neighborhoods that have a lot of these criminal activities, they're populated highly by persons of color, and that's an issue. And then you have to consider the fact that if we don't stop them, if we don't frisk them, then you have a lot of guns and knives and drugs that flow freely through our community. And then you have to call the fire to the police department in how they stop and where they stop and the way they approach people when they stop. And we have to teach parents that you can't send your 16-year-old to the store going down an area populated by drugs and drug dealers and don't let him come out the house with some kind of identification on him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that sounds like a stigma, but we live in Brooklyn, you know. No one should leave the house without some type of form of ID to identify themselves, some type of phone number to contact somebody to address, you know, what they're doing and where they're going, because a lot of the criminal activity that's happening is not happening from 40 and 50 and 60-year-old people. It's kids between the ages of 15, 16, 17, 20, 22, 24. And the more they're on the street, the more apt they're to be viewed in a negative connotation, not because the police want to, but because, unfortunately, it's the nature of the Brooklyn community that these things are happening. If you talk to the average cop in Brooklyn, they would much rather go through their whole day without interacting on a negative basis with anybody. They want to go home with their gun in their holster, their life in their hands, visit their families, and not bother. But that's not the lifestyle and the job that they've chosen. So on some levels, it's of controversy. But again, you can go both ways. Should they stop and frisk everybody all the time? Of course not. Do they need to stop some people because of the behavior and the action of the community that is in? By all means, in order to protect some, you may have to inconvenience others.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, you know, it definitely is a problem that, or an issue, that is with us and perhaps might be with us for some time. I know as a person living in the city of New York, I appreciate that the city is, for most people, much safer than it used to be. Just a few years ago, and you know, I travel a lot, I go out a lot, and so it is important to me to be able to travel, you know, without really being overly concerned and frightened of being able to go out in the city. At the same time, you know, looking at the statistics, looking at the numbers, talking to people, especially those who live in neighborhoods that have been targeted because they have higher crime rates than other parts of the city. You know, you talk about the police being a paramilitary organization, and the descriptions that I get from people are that they feel as though they are living in sort of a police state, that it's a community under siege, and that their responses to this are kind of ambivalent because on the one hand, you're right. Nobody's going to sign a petition saying all the police should stay home for the weekend on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, the question is, isn't there some kind of a medium, if not a happy medium, that can be reached? Are you aware of any conversations that are going on about that and about perhaps addressing, reforming the policy in the way that it's being implemented now?
All the time. Believe it or not, Mr. Raymond Kelly is extremely open to the community to discussing how they police our areas and the way they police our areas. People need to come out to their community council and their community board meetings and speak their mind and speak their piece and address their issues. I've been in these community meetings where just last week we was at a community council meeting in Brownsville, and a senior lady in a wheelchair said that she was coming down the block past the precinct where she lived, and some group of construction workers was throwing garbage from the roof down onto the ground without any paper or tape or warning to anybody that they were doing that. And when she complained to the worker, he said something very rude, and she went directly to the precinct, rolled into the precinct, and spoke to the officer at the desk. And the officer at the desk said, well, ma'am, you know, if you want some caution tape put up there, go to the hardware store and go buy it.
Oh, my.
She thought that was extremely rude. And right at that meeting, she brought it up to the deputy inspector who was there at the meeting that this officer, during this time of day, with these three or four badge numbers that she remembered, spoke to her in that fashion. And the inspector looked her dead in the face and said, I need to meet with you tomorrow morning with that individual. That individual will be easy to find, and we're going to address that behavior. But obviously, if she didn't bring that issue up, it would not have been addressed. So, yes, we can complain about their behavior, but until you go into the precinct and say, hey, this was out of order, this was disrespectful, this was wrong, they should have done it this way, they should have done it that way, then obviously these things will never be at least first brought to the forefront, and two, they won't be addressed, and three, some type of implementation of a different way of doing it will never be discussed. So it has to be, you know, brought to the forefront.
Well, it's so important that you're saying this and that you're saying this in this public forum. I do think that people get the sense that there's sort of a futility in saying anything, and so they don't. And it becomes this unfortunate vicious cycle where nobody says anything and nothing changes, and then they think that nothing changes because, well, nothing changes, and, you know, they don't say anything. So it is important to understand that there are folks at the precinct level and at the community level who are responsive and who are very concerned about improving policing in the neighborhoods that are impacted.
Right. These different precincts, believe it or not, the Commissioner Kelly and his whole executive staff reviews the civilian complaints that are coming into their different precincts. They actually have meetings. The DA's office holds trainings to help talk to the different police officers involved. The community affairs officers are brought in to discuss with the community what they can do to address complaints against the precinct. We also even have been invited by the precinct commanders to come into their roll calls, clergy, lay people, to speak to officers and let them know, hey, my name is, I live around the corner, this is the issue that I'm dealing with, and the police have not said this, the police didn't do that. What are they supposed to do in this? What is the procedure? What is the policy? You know, people keep forgetting that police officers have rules also.
Yes.
They got to follow certain mandates to keep their job. So it's not always that individual officer. It may be just a rule they have to follow. I had an incident where a pastor was pulled over by the police officer because he was on his cell phone. And when they tapped on the window to tell him to roll the window down and put the phone down, he was rude.
Mm.
And he said, I'm on the phone with a family member who's going through something. Give me a minute. You know, that's out of order. Officer's telling you to do something, you got to do what they tell you to do. You know, you hang up the phone. And subsequently, because of his behavior and his raucous discipline, he was detained. He wasn't arrested. He wasn't beaten up or anything like that, but they detained him to try to get him to understand that pull over if you want to have that phone call. You know, you can't. The rule is you can't be on your cell phone. And he knows that. He's a senior pastor. He knows better than that, but he felt like he could get away with it. So on one hand, the police are forced to do their job in a certain way because of their rules, and the community has to make sure that the way they do it is at least respectful and decent so people understand that I'm not trying to hurt you or harm you. I'm just trying to get you to understand there's certain laws that must be followed.
And it is really unfortunate when something that could have been resolved in 5 minutes now turns into a situation, you know, where somebody is being detained. And generally speaking, when a person is detained, they've got cuffs put on them, which is can be a traumatic situation in and of itself or a traumatic experience, whether or not the person's actually arrested and taken to booking and so forth. But, you know, you talked earlier about the embarrassment of it. You're out on the street, all of that. You don't have to have that experience if you are, you know, responsible in the way that you respond to contact with the police.
Exactly.
Right. Well, listen, I'd like to take just a little bit of a break, but when we come back, I would like to talk with you about Project Safe Surrender and how it operates, what a person can expect to do, see, to achieve if they choose to come to Antioch on Friday and Saturday coming up in April. So if you would mind, if you don't mind holding on for just a moment, we're going to go back and hear a little bit more from Somi. This song is called Hot Blue, and it is off her latest album called If the Rains Come First. And again, she will be recording this coming week at the Jazz Standard. She'll be recording her first live album. So if you're enjoying the music that you are hearing now and you are in the New York City area in the coming week, I urge you to come out and take a listen. Hot Blue.
Oh,
right. Welcome back to the show. This is Batabile Mtombeni coming to you live from Harlem, USA, and you are listening to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. I'm a mediator and relationship coach, and we are talking today with Reverend Joseph Jones, who is telling us about Project Safe Surrender, a program that is scheduled to take place on the, I believe it's the 28th and the 29th. He's going to correct me if I was wrong about the dates, but in April, where people can come to a church, the Antioch Church in Baptist Church in Brooklyn, and take care of outstanding warrants that they have. And so this is at the Antioch Baptist Church in Brooklyn. And now I'm going to ask Reverend Jones if he can talk with us about what a person can expect to experience if they decide to come to the Antioch Baptist Church, and you know, why it's a good thing for them to come, and why they should perhaps not feel so apprehensive about coming out, because I can imagine that a person who's been avoiding a warrant for a particular period of time, you know, thinks that things are going to go really badly. So, Reverend Jones, you're back on the air. Please talk with us a bit about the process. What can a person expect to experience when they come to the church?
Well, the event is going to be on the 22nd and the 23rd of April.
Ah, the 22nd and the 23rd. Thank you for that correction.
Not a problem. It's Good Friday and Holy Saturday, the weekend right before the Easter or Resurrection Sunday celebration. And what they can expect is a great deal of compassion and a great deal of opportunity for freedom. When they arrive at the Antioch Baptist Church, they'll be greeted by lay people and volunteers and clergy, not police, not anybody from the corrections department. It's just going to be a bunch of community and lay people and church people that's going to welcome them. There will be a lot of warmth and understanding that there is a great deal of apprehension, but because the church is leading the charge with the support of the DA, there will not be any reason for any fears or apprehension. We're not asking for any financial issues. You know, we just want you to come, bring your ID. Some will be invited by letter, and they'll stand online and be ushered into the sanctuary via the church's entrance. And in that room, they will receive a number, and from that number, they will start, the court personnel will start looking up these cases and pulling the cases and give them to the judge. And then we will usher them into the makeshift courtroom, which will be in the lower level, the dining hall. And they will be ushered to sit in a newly collected court, and they will be treated just like a court downtown Brooklyn. The court officer will just stand as not some security, but just as what the court demands if it was downtown. And the judge will hear their case, and they will vacate the warrant, which simply means that the police are no longer looking for you. It'll be immediately plugged into the court computer system that warrant has been vacated, because the clerks and the computers will be there. And then the judge will determine that the matter shall be dismissed, and you'll be ushered to receive documentation that same day, a disposition with the court seal on it, proving that this matter has been dismissed, so that even if, for whatever reason, we don't expect any problems, but if the computer has a glitch and it didn't get taken care of, you have written and documented proof that the matter has been resolved. And then we're going to offer an opportunity for you to be ushered to the Mount Pisgah Baptist Church, which is 760 DeKalb Avenue, which is about 6 blocks from Antioch, and go directly to our resource area, where we're going to have over 40 to 50 resources available to the community in the way of job opportunities, in the way of health service opportunities, in the way of community opportunities, food pantries, and things of that nature, to help people to reacclimate themselves into the system. And free food will be given to anyone that shows up. Free drink will be given to anyone that shows up, showing another side of the local church and the community issues. Because once you come out from under the mandate of a warrant and a case, you can now rejoin society. You don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be concerned. And you can actually get services for yourself and for your family. And that's what's going to happen on April 22nd and 23rd.
So it's important to understand then that there is a two-step process, because there are two issues that are outstanding. The underlying issue is the warrant. I'm sorry. The underlying issue is the ticket, you know, the violation. But then there's the issue of the warrant itself.
Exactly.
And so you're going to go into a process where, first of all, they take care of the warrant, so you no longer have to be concerned about being arrested.
Right. And then after that, they'll deal with your summons.
Okay. And I'm also very interested in the idea that you come through the sanctuary and then go downstairs for the makeshift courtroom.
Right. And while you're in the sanctuary, while you're in the sanctuary, we're going to have different presentations. There's going to be poems. There's going to be singing. There's going to be disseminated information. Different presentations from different organizations will be up to keep people engaged and let people know what services are available, and also to not necessarily entertain, but keep them engaged and keep them knowing that while the process may be a little busy, because we're hoping that we're going to be inundated, that no matter what happens, you'll still be receiving what they call favorable consideration. Not amnesty, but favorable consideration.
So the fact that you've come to this program adds a plus to you when they're deciding the case.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And then, of course, in terms of atmosphere, what you're describing is very different from what one might experience going to court and waiting for hours, because
right.
That's what usually happens when people have to go to court. You end up waiting for hours.
Right. And also, we have a team of attorneys from the Legal Aid Department, which is one of our partners, where if you have questions, for free of charge, there'll be an attorney standing outside from the Metropolitan Black Association, as well as from Legal Aid, and even volunteer attorneys from their own private practices will be outside, too. If you have any questions or concerns, or if you have some legal issue you want to address, if it's too much to discuss while you're online, they will give you their card and their phone number, and you can make an appointment free of charge to come and speak to them at a later date about any other issues that might be bothering you, along with the clergy who will be there to offer mentoring and monitoring services and support services, so that, let's say, for example, we've had the issue where somebody shows up not realizing that this is only for summonses. So let's say they have a misdemeanor case that's open, and they're thinking that if I come to, say, surrender, I'll get a better deal than I would if I go to court, you know, trying to circumvent the system. Well, those persons will be asked to step off the line and meet with an attorney, and their attorney will explain to them that this is not the program for them and that they must speak to their attorney, but they can definitely speak to a pastor and ask for some support services and some other information that might be able to help them in their case, even though this may not be the venue for them. Then there's some people that will come and say, hey, listen, you know what? I have a felony, and I have an open warrant. What can I do? Well, even if they come, the lawyers will take them off the line. The lawyers will document their case, and the lawyers will make sure they appear in court on the following Monday or Tuesday morning to have that matter resolved. So, again, it's safe surrender.
You know, the more you describe this, the more impressed I am by how comprehensive the program is, and also by the very fact that it exists. I mean, this isn't something that the legal system has to do.
Right.
But there is value, you know, that has been found from the DA's office in offering this kind of a program, considering the fact that, you know, the other methods of dealing with it haven't been working.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So I wanted to make sure that people who are listening really understand what happens with the process. If a person comes to the line, then somebody there is going to ask them why they're there.
Exactly. Or they'll have a letter that they received from the court. Or they heard about it on your show that they wanted to come down and see what it's all about. Or they want to be online, but nobody has even they don't even think they have a summons, but they're coming for the job resources or the community resources. And there'll be over 300 volunteers to pull them off the line and say, "Well, come with us. We want to work with you. Or come with us. We want to talk to you." And they'll administer whatever help they need to understand what they need to do for that day.
Right. And the other 300, I didn't know it was that big. Wow. You know, that is huge. When the other part of it that I thought was really important to emphasize is that then folks are going to have an opportunity to talk with a lawyer before they ever get inside and see a judge.
Exactly.
So that is really important, too. What kind of response did you receive last year? I know you said that it was a pilot project. The numbers were not as high as you thought they would be. But what were the reactions of people who came and went through the process?
Well, let me just say that we received over 100 people that day, and everybody went home. Everybody. Nobody left there in handcuffs. Nobody left there disillusioned or feeling like they were cheated or lied to in any way, shape, or fashion. There were some extraordinary stories. One in particular was a young lady showed up. She was 17 years old. She was the first person on the line at 8 o'clock in the morning. She was very shy, very demure, very quiet, and she stood on line by herself for a long time until the judge arrived at 9, and we set up everything for them to come through. And at 9:30, she saw the judge. She had her hand held by one of our clergy females, and when she went before the judge looked at her summons and recognized that the summons was not even properly written out, and that what she was supposedly charged with wasn't even an issue. She broke down and started to cry and said that she'd been ducking school for the past 2 months because she was afraid to tell her mother that she had received the summons in the first place. So now she was getting letters that she was missing school, and the mother was going on, what's going on with this, and why all of a sudden are you cutting school, and she was afraid to tell her, and all because she got a summons that wasn't even legally sufficient. And it may have been human error, it may have been the rush of the officer, who knows? All we know is that the matter was dismissed, and then she told us that she was afraid to ask her mother for any assistance, that she didn't even get any money to get on the bus or the train. So we said, okay, we'll take you back home. Where do you live? She said Queens.
She came all the way from Queens.
She walked from Queens.
She walked from Queens.
She walked from Queens to come to Safe Surrender in East New York, Brownsville. We had another lady that showed up, and her husband was hospitalized for major surgery, and she knew that he had an open warrant for trespass, and supposedly he went someplace, didn't have his ID. The officers wrote him a summons because he wasn't supposed to be there, and in that time frame, they misplaced the paper, forgot the date, didn't know when they should come, and as the attorney said earlier, this stuff happens, and he had a warrant, and when she heard about the program, he couldn't come because he was recovering from major surgery in the hospital. So she came to the program, stood online, stood before the judge with documentation that he was hospitalized and he couldn't come. The judge vacated his warrant and dismissed the case as if it never happened.
Just like that.
But the last lady, I think, was the one that made it solidified how we must do this program again. She was 82 years old. She came to the church for pantry, but she drove there because she has arthritis in her knees so bad she's not able to walk very far. And she saw the signs, and it was 5 o'clock. The Spanish interpreter was putting on her her bags and things to leave, and she said in Spanish that she wished her son could come. So we had someone there that spoke Spanish, and they spoke to her and come find out that the son was at home, and he had 2 open warrants for open beer cans. So we told her, get on the phone, call him, and tell him to come. And she said, I can't. He's drunk.
Oh.
He's home drunk. She said, yes, he's home drunk. So she said, well, in Spanish, she said to us that he's home drunk because he just got released from hospice. He's dying of throat cancer.
No.
And that's why he's been drinking. And she was just crying and sobbing and saying that I don't want my son to die with 2 summonses on his hand.
Oh,
so
wow.
we brought the story to the judge, called the Spanish interpreter back, ushered her through the back door of the church because she couldn't walk up the stairs into the church. So she circumvented the magnetometer. She circumvented the security we had in place, which is an example of how we deal with believers and sinners and things. They don't come through the front door. Sometimes they got to come through the back door.
Well,
and she came in. She sat down in front of the judge, and the judge asked her, did she have any documentation that her son was dying of cancer, that he had this illness? And she said, Your Honor, all I have is my word. And she looked at this woman and she said, well, I'm vacating both warrants. I'm dismissing both cases. Please go home and tell your son to be at peace.
Wow.
And she started crying. The judge started crying. The district attorney started crying. The court officers were sniffling. They ushered her out the door and gave her her food that she came to pick up in the first place. And a week later, that same lady came to church, joined the church, and brought her son.
My. Wow.
So it doesn't get any better than that.
Well, you know, what a testimony. What a testimony. You know, as you're telling these stories, now it becomes real. You know, it's not just about processes and procedures and programs. It's about human beings who are struggling with, you know, real human challenges. And to be able to get services in a context that usually seems so cold and uncaring, you know, when people think about going to court and the legal system, it's, you know, you become a docket number and you lose something of your humanity, at least, you know, that's the impression and the experience of many people going to court. So to get the kind of service and to get the kind of caring, you know, you mentioned with the first young woman that when she went before the judge, there was a church member who stood with her and held her hand as she stood there in front of the judge. And, you know, talking about the mother who had arthritis and was there, you know, to collect food, and the care that she was shown, making sure that she was able to get into the courtroom. It's those things that are so important. And, you know, it's part of the reason why I'm so glad to be able to have you here on the show talking about this program so that, you know, people can understand that there is a place where they will be treated with dignity, with kindness, and that whatever it is that they are accused of doing, you know, people are not there to judge them, but to offer them help.
Exactly. And the judge that's sitting on these cases is a former district attorney herself. So she's come through the ranks and been a great instrumental in working with many of the programs even before she became a judge. So her compassion level is very high in dealing with these community issues. So we have a great collaborative effort. The Judge Cammons, who's the administrative judge of the Unified Court System, is very good friends with the DA. So when we brought the program to him, I approached him on the street, right on Court Street, downtown Brooklyn, and spoke to him about the program. And he thought it was a wonderful idea and told me that he was going home to reinstitute his commitment to Mr. Hines that same day to say that he wanted to be a part of it and that he would be the second judge in case Miss the first judge, Dina Douglas, would get inundated. So there was a great deal of collaboration, and Legal Aid jumped on board, and the Brooklyn NAACP has now joined our forces, and now they're doing it because it's a social justice issue to help
right.
these people out from under. And we're looking for a major, we want to make sure that people know that this is a collaborative effort. As much as I'm talking about it and have been working with it, this could not have been done if many people hadn't come together and said, it must be done.
Right. Well, I, you know, I'm so glad. This program, as I said in the beginning, wasn't supposed to happen today, but I think it was. You know, I had a different program planned for today, and with the help and cooperation of quite a number of people, this show has come together. And I know that there's somebody listening out there for whom this information is especially important, and they needed to hear it today. So I'm very glad that we've had an opportunity to talk about this. I want to make sure that everyone listening has the information that they need in order to access this program. So I know you said that the Project Safe Surrender itself is going to be at Antioch Baptist Church, which is at 828 Green Avenue in Brooklyn. Is there any information that you can give about public transportation over there? Are there the trains that are nearby and the buses that are nearby?
Well, the closest train is the A train, which runs down Fulton Street. The buses that come that way, I believe, are the 47, the 26, the 48. These buses come within maybe 4 or 5 block walking distance to the church. The church is kind of situated right in the middle of the two areas, like it's between Myrtle Avenue, where the G train is at, and then it's between the B-25 bus, and so it's a short walk, but we're praying for good weather that day, warm weather that day, so that people don't have any problems getting there. Also, just to let you know, the court will be at 828 Green Avenue. The resources will be at Mount Pisgah, which is 760 DeKalb Avenue. But there's a phone number, 718-250-3888, where anybody who has that issue now can call, leave their name and their number, no information other than their name and number, then we can call them back. If they want to volunteer, they can call that number. We can run their name and make sure they don't have any warrants, and then they can come that day and work with us. If they think they do have a warrant, they can call now, and we can actually bring them to the court now and get that matter resolved now. They don't even have to wait until April 22nd, 23rd. Believe it or not, after the 23rd, the phone will still be on. The website will still be up, because we're looking to do this again in the fall. So let's say you just can't come. You've already got plans to go out of town for the Easter holiday weekend, and you just won't be here. Well, that's fine. When you get back, call that number, and we will still have the same access to the judge, to the court, to the lawyers, to the pastors, that we can still do safe surrender even in the courtroom downtown Brooklyn. Judge Douglas has made it mandatory that she opens her courtroom one day a week for several hours, so anybody that comes and says, I just missed it, can I still safely surrender? We will contact the pastors, we will contact the community services, bring that person in, stand before the judge, and whatever happened at Antioch will happen downtown Brooklyn. So these things are still going to be going on even after safe surrender. So they just need to call that number again, 718-250-3888, or they can go to projectsafesurrender2011.org, .com, and they can look that website up and get more information. The phone number that I just gave, 718-250-3888, I'm the only one that has the code to that number, so you'll be speaking directly to me. No one else will have access, so we can keep the integrity of the program. So anybody can call. They don't have to be afraid to call and leave their information, because I'm the only one that's going to get it.
Awesome. Wonderful. And the information that folks are going to be speaking directly to you, I think, is really, really important. When it comes to information that is this sensitive and a situation that is this sensitive, it is important that they know who they're going to be talking to and who is going to be getting into their business.
Exactly.
So you will be speaking directly with Reverend Jones, and that's really, really important. I'm looking here at the website, Reverend Jones. I want to make sure that we know whether it's .org or .com. I have it up here as .org. Does it matter either way?
Okay. No, it is .org. Okay.
It is .org.
Yeah.
Okay.
It
great.
Is
.org. So that, right, and the website is really great. It gives a list of the violations that are eligible for people to come in for this program. I'm not going to read the whole list. It's actually quite an interestingly long list.
Right.
That,
but also, you know what I just forgot to mention?
Yes.
We just solidified with transit. Transit summonses are very different than criminal summonses. Transit summonses do not result in a warrant. They result in a civil judgment. So let's say you jumped a turnstile. Let's say you had your feet up in a chair and you got a ticket, or you brought coffee on the train, or some kind of altercation happened on the train and you received a summons. If you didn't appear on that summons, which many of the children get because of their travels, and they didn't tell their mom and dad they got this little pink ticket, they now have not received a warrant, but they received a civil judgment. So later on when they go for credit issues, it's going to come up, and it's going to be tacked on with fees and penalties. But we have an agreement with the Transit Bureau that anybody that shows up for a transit issue, they will receive a documented form with the court seal on it to take back to the Transit Adjudication Bureau and have that matter heard, and their fees and their penalties will be waived. So even though they may have to make another stop down at the court, they're going down with documentation that they already safely surrendered and that there is no reason to mandate any civil judgment against them, and no additional fees will be charged to them, and they can still have their matter taken care of with favorable consideration.
But, you know, the important thing that I'm hearing here, it's really, you know, you talk about a kid who makes an unfortunate mistake when they're young and how it can come back to bite them later.
Exactly.
At the most inopportune time, when they're applying for credit, when you're trying to you know, purchase a car or purchase a home, all of a sudden something that you did when you were 13 can stand in the way of you achieving, you know, whatever goal it is that you're trying to achieve. And the other important part then, of course, is that it's an opportunity to experience mercy, where, you know, you would have had all of these fines with, you know, the additional penalties tacked on, and have a chance to get all of that waived. So it's really important to get this stuff taken care of. Come in, take care of it. It's much better to deal with it now than to let it sit when you have a chance to get it taken care of. We're coming down to the last few moments here of the show, actually. Things have time has really flown by. We've been talking about things that are really important. Reverend Jones, thank you so much for being with us. Are there any last messages that you would like to leave us with?
Well, just to let people know just what you just said, they really need to come. In order to make this program a mainstay in our community, we have to show the court, the police, the DA, the legal aid, that we want this program. So if we come out in great, great, great numbers, then they will be forced to deal with all of our issues and all of our friends. And I want to remind people that the integrity of the program lies in the heart of our DA and in the spirit of the churches that are in partnership with us. If you don't trust the police, if you don't trust the court, if you don't trust the system, trust the fact that the church will not allow anyone to be arrested, anyone to be disrespected, and anyone to be harmed in any way. They can freely come and safely surrender. And that way they know that there is still integrity in some places of government and in community. So we look forward to everyone showing up and coming and making this program a great success so that we can prepare for the next one and the one after that.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I'm very honored to have had you here on the show and have had an opportunity to bring these issues out to my listeners. And I also want to thank Andrew G. March, who was so wonderful in coming in to talk in the beginning about the procedures, the legal procedures that were involved in these matters. Thank you so much for listening in. This has been Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer. We are here every week from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock on Sunday afternoons talking about various issues regarding relationships. And today we were talking about the relationship between the criminal justice system and communities of color and the church. So we talk about relationship issues on a grander scale as well as on an interpersonal scale. We try to bring you important information each week that will be helpful to you. So I invite you to join me again next week at the same time, 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, for our next show. And I'll be putting up information about the topic of our next show in a few days. Thanks again for listening. You're going to be hearing Somi again from her album, If the Rains Come First. And the song is called Be Careful, Be Kind. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Grace to match her beauty.